Let me invite you this morning to turn in the Gospel of Matthew to the 24th chapter. And in just a moment, we'll begin a study from that particular part of the Scripture. I want to make this announcement this morning that tonight in the worship hour, I'll be answering questions. So there is a list of the questions that have been submitted already in the foyer. And I invite you to submit some more. So if there are questions that you've been wanting answered and wanting them dealt with now, this is your opportunity. There'll only be a distance of a few hours between the time you raise it and the time at least we'll make the attempt with the help of the Lord to respond to it. So keep that in mind. Life to be good, demands that we experience some very sobering moments. I don't think it is possible for us to keep ourselves focused on reality without those experiences. We concluded last Sunday a series of studies in the book of Ecclesiastes. And if you recall, the concluding exhortation of Solomon was that you should remember what life is about. That your whole intention, God's dream and purpose for you, what life is all about, is that you should fear or reverence God and keep His commandments. Now, I don't think that that's too much of a revelation. That if God made us, and if God keeps us, and God holds us, we do not have any calling greater than to do His will. Insofar as we fail, we are failing at the kindergarten level. But what he said to strengthen the importance of fearing God and keeping his commandments was that God will bring every work into judgment. There is to be a parting of the ways for human beings. There is to be judgment. Now, to help us understand this morning that that isn't an idea that was just contained in the mind of Solomon, or that was only a part of a dark Old Testament world, I bring you to the Son of God today and His teachings on judgment, Jesus and judgment. And the setting is Tuesday, in the week in which Jesus died. And Jesus and James and John and Peter and Andrew have just exited from the temple ground. We learn from Mark and Luke that they had been inside, likely the court of the women. And Jesus had them standing there watching as various individuals came and gave into the temple treasury. And he said nothing about several men who came and gave very abundant gifts, and only spoke when a widow came and with two tiny coins, cast in all that she had. And then Jesus said, that's what you need to look at. Coming out, the disciples were struck for one reason or another with the magnificence of this temple. And I can tell you that as nearly as we can determine reading Josephus, who may have exaggerated a bit now and then, that the temple that Herod the Great began to build 19 B.C., about the 18th year of his reign, in order to curry favor with the Jewish nation that never loved him, never really accepted him in any sense gladly as their ruler, he enlarged the temple of the restoration, the one that Zerubbabel and his cohorts had built 400, 500 years before. And he made it a remarkable place. If anything could have exceeded Solomon in the construction of the temple at its beginning. We are told that the face of the temple stood 150 feet high. That is the alcove, the tower, by which you would enter into the sanctuaries of the temple. 150 feet and 150 feet wide. And that the opening into that alcove was over 100 feet high. The walls were 7 to 9 feet thick and sometimes twice that. And on the exterior of this temple built of glistening, polished white stone, there was attached gold leaf and gold decoration. In the 23rd chapter of Matthew, Jesus speaks of it indirectly by talking about how the Pharisees argued that if you swear by the gold of the temple, you ought to keep your oath, but not if you swear by the temple. So there was gold there. And to see this immense building erected on top of already an already prominent hill, and to see that white stone with its gold appointments glistening in the sun must have been an awe-inspiring sight as you came over the hill from Bethany and looked down and saw it. Today's mosque that sits upon it, the Dome of the Rock, is almost a scar by comparison with what Solomon's temple and Herod's temple would be. And they were impressed. And they called Jesus' attention to its beauty. And Jesus said, "Judgment is come." He said it in these words, "The time is coming when not one stone of this magnificent structure will be left upon another. Judgment is coming." Now that was a shattering kind of comment. I'm not sure how much biblical, historical perspective these four men had. But it would not have been the first time in history that a nation of Jews looked at the temple and said, "This is the place of our refuge. As long as it stands and it's going to stand forever, we don't have anything to worry about. This is the house of God." And they were right in that. Jesus had said, "It's my Father's house. And it's not to be a place of merchandising. And absolutely not to be a place for thievery." And he ran them out, these sellers, these merchandisers, twice in his public preaching life. But he also said once when he was discussing this subject that one greater than the temple is here. And so he startles the disciples by saying, "This is going to be ended. This will not last. Whatever you may think of it, however immense it may appear, however significant it may appear, even in connection with the purposes of God, it is going to be destroyed." Having been fascinated with the temple splendor, they are equally disturbed by Jesus' statement now. They don't ask him immediately. They're too shocked, I suppose. Going down out of the temple courtyard. And they have proceeded all the way across the Kidron up to the Mount of Olives on the other side. before they take him aside and say, what did you mean by that? What were you saying? When shall these things be? And what is the sign of thy coming and of the end of the age or the world? For these men, they were asking one question. For so far as they were concerned, if this house fell, it was over. Everything was over. And Jesus would certainly have come. Come as the great Messiah King. Come to rule the world. Come to destroy all his enemies and to exalt those who were his followers. It would be the end of an age, the end of the world. Jesus begins in his discussion in chapter 24 with the destruction of Jerusalem. And you can tell as you read the account that's given that it's going to be a time of great disruption. There will be wars, and there will be rumors of wars, and there will be earthquakes, disturbances of all kinds. It will be an age of great upheaval. And in particular, he's pointing to the circumstances surrounding this nation, the nation of Israel. It would be a time of great disturbance. And finally, after a lot of liars come on the scene to tell the nation about the real answer to all the problems, Messiahs, false Christs, who come to declare that the answer is to be found in military power, the answer is to be found in linking up with some other national force. The answer is to be found. That's the same old story of Jewish history. When the time came that men needed to face the fact that they are nose to nose with God, and they are not prepared to meet him, their sins are obvious. Their indifference to him, clear. They want to talk about some palliative, some nostrum of some kind or another that's going to solve the problem without solving the problem. That's what Jesus is talking about here. People who come with the answers. And then he says in verse 15, the abomination of desolation, which Daniel spoke about in his prophecy, would stand in the holy place. The abomination of desolation in the holy place of God. Now that's an expansion on the destruction of the temple. Now the pollution of it. And then he warns that those that are in Judea should flee to the mountains. And all the warnings given here are not warnings that would be given in the face of some heaven sent judgment of God upon all nations, in which every single individual is brought before him and called to account for his life. That's not what's being described here. He's saying, run. And hope that your flight's not on the Sabbath day when the gates will be closed. Or not in the winter. Or not when you are with small children. What we know of those days between 66 and 70 A.D. is that they were horrendous times. And then he says in verse 28, wherever the carcass is, wherever the corpse is, there will the eagles or the vultures be gathered together. That's what's going to happen to the city. And the implication, even the direct statement is, the Son of Man will come in this. The destruction of the city of Jerusalem is the judgment of God. It will be the judgment of the Son of God upon this city that has rejected the will of the Father, that has rejected the Father's Son. And then verse 31, he will send forth his angels, his messengers, the great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of the heaven to the other. I suspect that he is speaking simply there about the proclamation of the gospel to the world, although it's spoken in very dramatic terms, and the drawing of the people of God to him. Now, I recognize that there is a problem in this text about whether we're talking about the destruction of Jerusalem and the judgment upon that nation that took place 70 A.D., or is he speaking about some final, total, absolute judgment at the end of all time? And if he is talking about the latter, when does he begin to talk about the latter? There are some problems about that. I don't have time to get into it today, but I will tell you that you're going to have to make the transition. You can't keep on talking about the destruction of Jerusalem all the way through chapter 24 and then slide into chapter 25 with those three parables we're going to talk about briefly this morning. Because it becomes apparent when you get into chapter 25, he's talking about ultimate judgment. Not something that happened in history a long time ago, but something that yet confronts us, and not just one nation of men, but all nations of men. Therefore, I have judged that verse 34 is a transitional point. Verily, I say to you, this generation shall not pass away till all these things be accomplished. All the things preceding. That should be a textual clue that what he has been talking about so far is an event in history. In particular, God's judgment upon this rebellious city. And then, I think, he begins to pass, though there are some difficulties connected with Luke 21, into a consideration of a broader judgment. Somewhere along here, he's taking us in. It's not just something that was going to be seen by that generation, but now something that encompasses us. I said earlier that we need some sobering moments in our lives. We need some joyful ones too. I know that. And I believe there are many. But I don't think it's possible to find the joy without the sobriety. And sometimes I just need to be shaken. I wish it were not necessary. I'm ashamed that it is. But it becomes very clear to me that I drift sometimes. But I just take one step after the other and forget about the direction of things, lose attention upon the compass, and before I know it, I have gotten rather indifferent to certain significant, magnificent truths. Dr. Johnson, who was quite an essayist, British, English essayist, and has left us all kinds of quotations. He wrote all these things down, I suppose. I don't think they had tape recorders in Dr. Johnson's day. But he was having a discussion one day with some of his friends who were very cynical about life, really. Very irreverent toward eternal considerations, I should say. And he said, sometimes I'm afraid of death. Because I'm afraid I'm going to be condemned. And one of his friends said, what do you mean, afraid? What are you talking about, being condemned? He said, I mean going to hell, sir, and being lost forever. That's what I mean. He wasn't a very good man. But he had sense enough to be afraid of what is fearful. You don't need to be most afraid of bungee jumping. It'd terrify me. And there's some other things that hold all kinds of terrors, but those are nothing. Nothing compared to standing in the presence of the living God who's giving you breath, who has brought you into existence and maintained you all your days, and asked to give an answer for the life that you have lived. By three parables, Jesus addresses the subject. The first of them is a parable out of the social life of the day. It's a wedding. It's a wedding. More extensive probably than our own, although ours get very extensive. There was a betrothal when the two the young man, the young lady, would be considered linked to each other. It's not so informal nor so inconsiderable as our engagement. Our engagement to marry can be broken without disrepute. A betrothal under Jewish law could not be broken without a divorce. And anyone who was found in a sexual intimacy was someone who was betrothed, was guilty of a capital crime. He'd be executed. That's how serious it was to them. Sometimes the bridegroom would give a dowry to the wife of the bride. There were various methods. But the day would come when the joyous occasion for the uniting of these two would arrive. And so the bridegroom and all his friends would get together, and the bride and all her friends would be together. And I'm not sure whether there was any game here involved in trying to catch the bride and her attendants by surprise. Now, that might have been the case. We have a lot of those sort of social games in weddings today. I remember some of them. I've never been guilty of doing that to anybody else. But putting Limburger cheese on the manifold, that ain't too smart. I mean, rocks in the hubcaps, things of that sort that call attention to you in one way or another. Trying to mess up your car, you know, have to hide the car in a garage somewhere to keep that innocent kind of games, should be. I think I told you about the people that followed the couple all the way to their first stop, and when they got settled in, went banging on the door saying they wanted to come in and play 42. They didn't receive a very warm reception, I don't think, that night. And I thought that's carrying it too far. But the point that I'm getting at is that there were a set of joyful celebrations in connection with this wedding. And Jesus says there were 10 young ladies who were friends of the bride. And the groom and his friends are going to come, and they're going to take the bride to his house. But it's night, evidently, or it so proceeds, and they have to have their lamps ready to receive the arrival of the wedding party. And they delayed. They say it's the women who are late, but it is the men who are late here. And they don't get there on time when it was suspected they would come. And some of these young ladies didn't have enough oil in their lamps, and so they had to depart the scene and go get some. Well, that's the story. And when they were gone, what happened? The bridegroom, the voice, the shout, the cry went up, the bridegroom is coming, the bridegroom's coming. And the others, they were ready, but five didn't make sufficient preparation. I'm sure that had happened before. I'm sure this is not some sort of untoward, unusual experience. It was just something that you would have thought about in connection with the wedding. Be sure the preparation is properly made here. Be sure that all the attendants are ready. You know how it is. All the preparing and fixing, and is the food just right? Are the arrangements made just so? Do we have everything in place? And my feeling is that marriage is nothing compared to what it takes to have a wedding. If we could just get that much energy invested in marriage, I think we'd be well down the road. What's the point in this parable? Preparedness. He has said earlier, in a day and an hour when you think not, the Son of Man comes. What he's stressing in this particular parable is that you need always to be prepared. It's not a matter of every now and then having this kind of urgent, well, I better get things straightened up. And then you go through a sort of an explosion of concern, and then that dies away, and then you get back to business as usual. That's not going to work. That's not going to work here. Have you ever thought, you remember school days? How many fire drills did you go through in your school days? Fire drills. We hadn't had a fire around there in I don't know how long. And not only that, tornado drill. Everybody under the sea. You got to know which place to go. And when they have the fire drill, well, of course, why do we do that? Why do we go through these constant drills for catastrophes that we think never come? Because if they ever do, and we are not prepared for them, what's going to happen? And so we drill. I don't know that we have any drills for this. I'm not suggesting to you there's any drill for this. I'm suggesting to you there is an attitude of heart and mind that carries this thought with one always, and that is that Jesus may come at any time. It is an awareness of the heart. And preparation is made on the basis of that. So that each hour that I live, each day that I exist, I am very much aware of this possibility. In the ancient church, as 1st and 2nd Thessalonians indicates to us, their problem was a fascination and almost fixation upon the second coming of Jesus. In fact, it got to be so great that they virtually left their duties and responsibilities, the day-to-day acts that needed to be taken care of. And they became lazy and busybodies. And that created a problem in the church in Thessalonica. Young church. But that's not our problem. If they were too fascinated with it and too overwhelmed with it, they weren't taking care of business. We are underwhelmed by it all. We do not think in terms of the fact that Jesus may indeed come today. Or he may arrive tonight, or he may arrive in the morning. That is not our sensitivity. But it must be. It does not mean that in preparing for his coming that we leave off our responsibilities and duties. In fact, it's the very opposite. In preparing for his coming, we do everything we need to be doing. We are conscientious to accomplish that. At the end of chapter 24, he speaks about the servant who presumes that his master will not come and begins to abuse his fellow servants and not to attend to his duties. And he says, that man will be cut in pieces. I thought I don't think he was talking about the judgment of God, but he's talking about what happened in that Oriental society when slaves were were owned by their masters and there was no quarter given. Well, what happened to these young ladies who came back to their post only to find that the event for which they had been waiting had already transpired? And the bridegroom has taken the bride and carried her with her party into his house, and they have gone into the wedding feast, and the door is shut. And this moment, so far as this particular moment is concerned, so far as the task and duty and responsibility of these young ladies is concerned, it's over. You have missed it. There will be no rerun. And not only that, the door is shut. And I get the significance there. You are shut out in the darkness, and that's all there's going to be. You won't be at the wedding feast. Think about that, Jesus said. Think about that. And secondly, he takes us to the world of business. And a lesson about stewardship. First one's about being prepared. And the second one about how to be prepared. He tells the story of three household servants whose master is going away, and he gives them some money. One he gives 5 talents. That doesn't mean a lot to us, but that was a fair sum of money. And then to another, he gives 2, and to another 1. Each according to his ability. Now, my impression is he's giving them some money in terms of what ability he thinks they may have to make use of it. And so he gives them the money and then departs. But we all understand, and they understood, that this is just the beginning of things. That he'd be back again. And when he got back, he'd have some expectations that the money that had been put into their keeping would have been enlarged. invested and enlarged. And so it happened that the one that had five talents of money made investment of it, and he doubled his money. And the same thing is true of the one who had the two talents. He doubled what he had. But the whole story is focused on one fellow. That's the man that had one. Now, I don't know why it was one, not five. But Jesus chose this fellow to be the one who took that talent and hid it in a safe place. He said he knew that his master was a tough fellow. And what he was afraid of was that he'd lose the one talent and then he'd really be ruined. So he was going to hold on to that, bury it in the ground to keep it. Conservatism, wrong kind. Reminds me of the story of the wife and husband going uphill on a bicycle built for two. It was a struggle all the way, and they finally got to the top. The husband said, "I didn't think we'd make it." She said, "We wouldn't have if I hadn't had the brakes on to keep us from rolling back down the hill. Wouldn't have made it." And some of us, we're going to play it safe. I'm not going to try anything so I don't fail. This not to try is to fail. I want you to notice what the master of this man called this fellow. He didn't say, "You haven't been too good. You know, you should have done better than that. I appreciate the fact you didn't lose my talent, but I sort of expected some more." He said, "Wicked and slothful servant." Well, why? Because he made no investment of himself. It had nothing to do with how much the return was. I know that the fellow that had five got five more, that's ten, and the fellow that had two, he got two more, that's four. But the comparison was not with, well, this fellow's got ten, and here you've got one, and this fellow's got four, and you've got one. That is not the issue. The issue is, he didn't take what he had been given with the ability that was granted him and make use of it. And there are too many of us saying, "Well, you know, I can't do that. They do so well, and I'm not up to that, and there's no way I can do those things those other people are doing." And I want to tell you, that isn't the issue, and God never was concerned about in the first place. What he's concerned about is whether you're doing what you can do. Nobody can do what you can do, and what they can do too. And God wasn't looking at quantification here. He wasn't looking at amount here. He's looking at what we give of what we've got. There are some who might indeed gain a lot, but the point is they could have gained more, that there was no real investment of themselves. And with too many of us, that's our story. I mean, some of us are playing it safe this way. We're saying, I've stopped my drinking, I've stopped my smoking, I've stopped all that lying I used to do, and stopped all that cussing and so forth, and I'm trying to keep away from all that. Yes, that's very good. That'll get you in a good place to do something, but you haven't done anything yet. Where is the investment of oneself? Where is the growth, the spiritual growth? Where is the activity that becomes a blessing to other people? And particularly and always preeminently in the matter of saving the souls of men from an obvious disaster. We're not going to be judged by other people. They may think us good or they may think us bad, but that's neither here nor there. Paul says it's a small thing to him if he's judged by men's judgment in 1 Corinthians 4, 2 and 3. And we can't judge ourselves, as Paul warns in 2 Corinthians 10 and verse 12. It's not the man that commends himself, but whom the Lord commends. And we've got to seek to please him. I need to be concerned about my role in the kingdom of heaven, whether I'm doing what I need to be doing. What other people are doing is their business. But what I do with what I've been given is my business. And I take it that what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 4 that if any man ministers, let him minister according to the strength which God supplies, that he's saying to us, you give back as you've been given. Some of us need to think about our giving financially, and that's a small matter, I understand. We have been given a lot. And abundantly. Not only in money, but in health. And family. And we need to ask ourselves often as we give, is this, and not just in this assembly, but generally, does this reflect what I have been given? And some of us will have to say, God has been stingy indeed if it's a reflection of what He's given me. And the way He's given. There ought to be a joy in that giving. And a delight. I will give an account of my stewardship. Because what I have is not mine. Time, energy, opportunity. All this God has given. And He will call me to account. Finally, a judgment scene. He gets down past the metaphor to the real thing. This is a judgment. Son of Man is come in His glory, and all His angels are gathered round Him. A scene of power, immensity. And all nations gathered before Him. All nations. All men. Every man. Not just a few. Not just most, but every man. And then He says He will separate them like a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. The goats were used to lead the sheep. And the time came when the two were separated. The flock was separated from the goats. And the issue that's going to be the basis of judgment here is whether you have loved other men. Now, I want you to understand here this morning that that's not the only basis of judgment, but I want this to be said, that it is a critical basis of judgment. That there's no way any of us are going to make it if we have not loved others. And I want us to think as I'm going through this, as we're going through this together, I want us to think about people that we have difficulty loving and have not loved. Don't think about the pleasant ones. But the ones that need, even if they are not too appealing. Verse 34, then shall the king say to them on his right hand, come, you blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry and you gave me to drink, I was thirsty and you to eat, and I was thirsty and you gave me to drink, and I was a stranger and you took me in, naked and you clothed me, sick and you visited me, in prison and you came to me. And then shall the righteous answer him, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or fed you or thirst and gave you drink, and et cetera, et cetera. And he said, inasmuch as you did it to the least of these, my brethren, did it unto me. They were unaware of all this, but then they weren't keeping account. They weren't saying, well, I've helped so many sick people today, that's enough, that's a quota for today. I've shown love to so many people that needed encouragement, that's my quota for today. No quotas here. As many people as I can, as I have opportunity and ability to help, that's my task. That's my responsibility. That's my stewardship. And so Jesus said, you know, you did that. Come, you blessed of my Father. And then he turned to the others. And he said, when you saw me hungry, you didn't feed me. When you saw me thirsty, you didn't give me anything to drink. And when you saw me sick, you didn't visit me. And when you saw me in prison, you didn't minister to me. And they said, why? When did we see? And he said, inasmuch you did it not to the least of these, my brethren, you did it not to me. And then these awful words in verse 41, then shall he say also to them on the left hand, depart from me, you cursed, into eternal fire, which is prepared for the devil and his angels. Jesus said that? The loving Christ, the one who said God so loved the world that He gave His only begotten Son, that whosoever believes on Him should not perish but have everlasting life. Absolutely, He said this. And He's talking about people who will not believe and who saying they believe, will not serve Him, but make a great pretense of it. He's talking about people here as He goes through who will not give enough. Who will make some preparation, but it's never quite enough. It's just stick your hand in. It's just hold your membership so that they won't kick you out. do as little as you can to hold on to some relationship here, but don't give your heart and don't give yourself. I'm saying to you today that in all these parables, the giving of yourself is imperative. And the using of all that you have been given to serve Him is imperative. And being concerned not about yourself but about others is imperative. And that's the picture. Judgment is coming, He said to the disciples. It's an awful scene, this last one. Talks about eternal life and everlasting punishment. And it's real. And we have to be jerked awake sometimes. Now I want to conclude by taking you back to that scene on the Temple Mount. And they're so excited about that temple. This present reality. So beautiful. So, well, it looked almost eternal. And it wasn't. So you and I need to remember when we're walking through the house and saying, oh, taking our friend, see our house. Not one stone upon another. Look at my new car. Not one fender left. Not one wheel intact. Judgment is coming. See my lovely electronic equipment. Stereo that would make reality blush. Wonderful, exquisite, yes. Not one stone upon another. Judgment is coming. Life is not about these. Life is about serving God with the whole heart. Soberly, responsibly, investing ourselves in the kingdom. And I want to ask this morning, what are you building your hope on? How do you propose? What information have you received? Totally contrary to what's said here, that would cause you to feel that you can stare God in the face heedlessly and never ever have to give an account for the anger and the malice and the bitterness and the lust and the dishonesty that has characterized your life or mine. It won't happen. There's joy in Christ, but not to those who heedlessly discount all responsibility and think they can live this life without a thought of God. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. And if it is going to happen, I can tell you this much. Jesus is not the Son of God. He is a liar and a cheat and a fraud. I don't think you believe that. I think you believe that He is the Christ, and I think you know that these words are true. Now, all that's left is for you to act wisely and soberly. If you're not a Christian, to seek His face in faith and be baptized into Him for the forgiveness of your sin. And if you are a disciple who's been walking sort of tentatively through this so-called Christian life, and you have managed to invest something here and there, now and then, in the kingdom of heaven, but you have not been serious, you have not been sober. Now's the time to be sober, because in an hour when you do not think, He will suddenly be on the scene. And it will all be over except the accounting. May God grant that we will be ready, always ready when He comes. That's the intention of what Jesus said and what I've echoed of what He said this morning. While we're standing and saying,